This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
But I'd like to introduce Jeannie Bell, who was from the Batchelor Institute in the Northern Territory, the Centre for Australian Linguistics and Languages. Languages and linguistics. Mm-hmm. That's the way it goes. And Jeannie, I wanted to start by asking you where you're from originally.
Well, I'm another Queenslander, so I guess they're everywhere, aren't they?
Yeah. Which part and which people?
Before I start talking about that, I'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people from this particular area of the country and thank Auntie this morning, Agnes.
Auntie Agnes.
Yeah, for that lovely welcome. I'm originally from southeast Queensland. And I was born in Brisbane and grew up in Brisbane. My family, my parents, who are both of Aboriginal descent, came from southeast Queensland. My father came from the Gamilaroi people, we think, on our paternal grandmother's side. And his father was... blood father was a son of a white station owner in southeast Queensland who we never knew, although I think I've inherited some of my traits from some of that family. And his real father was a full blood Aboriginal man from southeast Queensland. He was a Yugara man who lived in the Brisbane Valley and lived on a station also and never came under the Queensland Act. So he was always a free Aboriginal. He spoke language as well as good English. My mother's side came from... My mother was born in Hervey Bay, and her grandmother and mother were descendants of the Doingbara people from Fraser Island, who spoke a dialect of the Gubbi Gubbi language and connected to the Batchelor language, which is the language that I probably know the best of all traditional languages because I've studied it over many years and written a thesis on it. And also her father was a white man who came from Norway or Sweden, another family that we didn't ever know. And her grandfather on her mother's side was from the Solomon Islands. So, yes, there's many, many kind of histories. I identify as an Aboriginal person, though, and grew up in Brisbane, yeah.
So in growing up in Brisbane, did you speak any language or did you learn language yourself?
No, the only language I learnt was English, and I guess they taught us well, as David spoke about. I guess I was at school in Brisbane in the 50s and early 60s. I heard lots of language spoken by elders in our communities, and our families. Not everyone spoke it, but many of the older people still spoke language. And the languages they spoke were generally from the two... My brother's just arrived. Came from the two main language groups, or the three main language groups of southeast Queensland, which are the Waka Waka languages and the Gubbi Gubbi languages and the Yugara languages, which cross over into northern New South Wales.
And even though you didn't speak personally, did you have a knowledge of those languages yourself?
I think, you know, I felt very influenced by some of the older people that spoke language. I loved to listen to them speak. I didn't understand a lot of what they said, but we knew lots of words. So we could listen and hear words that we were familiar with and that we used all the time in our English. So we mixed the words, you know, on a regular basis. And that was probably the beginnings of what's known today as Aboriginal English, because that happened all over the country. It didn't just happen in southeast Queensland, so, yeah.
When I was doing my research with Steve Renoff on the book The Pearl, two generations before, in the Renoff household, they weren't permitted to speak language. Mm-hmm. It was a sort of an internal decision from Steve's grandfather and grandmother. But... That happened a lot, didn't it?
It did, yeah.
Why was that?
Well, especially in our parents' and our grandparents' generation, because very early on in Queensland history, They decided that they wanted to, they couldn't control the Aboriginal people who were wandering around their own traditional countries. So they had to, and there had there'd been a lot of massacres, and there'd also been a lot of trouble with Aboriginal people stealing cattle or sheep. So there was lots of, and there was lots of illegitimate children being born. So they decided that they would form these communities, or reserves as they were called, and they were managed quite often by the churches, and they rounded people up and sent them to those places. So when they got to those places, and Cherbourg of course is one of the most well known in southeast Queensland, and there was another reserve which was managed by the Salvation Armies near Ipswich, outside of Ipswich, which was called the Deeming Creek Mission. And our paternal father, our father's mother, paternal grandmother, and her sister ended up there. They had been rounded up from around St George area when they were 12 years old, yep, in the 1890s. And our mother and many of her family from Hervey Bay had been sent to Cherbourg.
So what then?
And language and culture was forbidden. So the Anglican Church managed the Cherbourg Reservation and the Salvation Army. They sent them to school, so they were teaching them the white ways or the European ways, and English, of course, was a very important part of that. Yep.
So how was that policed?
By the superintendents mainly, and the people that were the church workers or the missionaries that were at the reservations. And I guess, you know, there were teachers brought in to the schools. They only, in my mother and father's generation, they only went to school to grade four. After they left school at grade four, I'm not sure. My mother's story was that there was a Torres Strait Islander teacher at the school at that stage, and she used to go into the school and help with the younger children. So she was kind of like a teaching aide, I think, what you would call an Indigenous education worker today. And she also, by the time they were getting on to be, you know, 13, 14, they then were sent out to work. So I guess I'm not sure in that period in between what they were doing. They were training them to be domestics, I think, and other types of workers, yeah.
And were there penalties for speaking language?
Well, that's what we were told. And I guess the one I've heard people mainly say is that they would have their mouth washed out with soap. I mean, or they were sent to the dormitories, or they were locked up in dark rooms and punished. They were punished for a lot of things. And quite often they were also punished by older Aboriginal people who had taken on the roles of, you know, helping to grow these children up. Because my mother always talked about a boiling pot on a fire outside the dormitory where an old lady who didn't have any legs sat, and she was always threatening to throw them in the pot. You know, like those kind of stories. And I mean, you know, oral history is wonderful in many ways, but quite often it does get changed along the way. So we have to be careful with that.
So what do you see as the impact of that sort of decision at Cherbourg to deny language to those who lived at Cherbourg?
Well, again, it's a similar process or pattern that happened all over Australia and in the Torres Strait. And I think that the situation today is that, and this has been the case for the last few decades, is that we have many younger generations. I mean, my generation and much younger, maybe not the little children because they don't really understand the impact of it so much yet, but many generations have become very angry and resentful at the loss of language and culture, and have felt that part of our identity was stolen or denied us. You know, we weren't allowed to have access. We didn't get the opportunities to learn in the ways that would have been done in traditional ways. And, you know, we all know that societies change, and once there are dominant groups that come into country, that obviously you are channeled or pushed into other ways of being. But I guess there's a deep down grieving and sense of loss that people feel about not having access to language and not being able to speak language. And I guess we still use it to shape our identity, and part of that is through the efforts around the country to revive language and to try and maintain languages that are still alive. And we all know that that's you know, that's a loaded gun in many ways because, you know, there's not many examples of success around the world with language revival. You know, we can name a few, perhaps Welsh, perhaps Hebrew, and we've had a few really good examples of success in Australia. But it's the effort that goes into the, which is part of the healing of bringing that back and giving people an opportunity to look at the world through the eyes of the traditional language, which connects us to the land, which connects us to our ancestors, and that's a very important part of who we are.
Because that's been your life's passion, really, hasn't it?
It has.
With the Gubbi Gubbi.
Yeah, the Batchelor and the Gubbi Gubbi, but mainly with the Batchelor. That's a language that I learnt through tapes that had been recorded and lodged at the IATSIS audiovisual area and in the documented area, manuscripts and such. One of our grandfathers, who wasn't a bloodline grandfather, but he was through the tribal connections, he was a grandfather to our father's father, and he had been recorded by a number of linguists in the 50s and the 60s, and the taped information was lodged. The material did get originally recorded by two linguists, one that lived here in Canberra, Stephen Verm, and another linguist from the Netherlands, Niels Holmes. And then there were other people that did a little bit of work on those languages as well. And then I kind of did some work on Batchelor. Yep.
So when did you start that work? When did you...
Well, I guess I always had a memory of that old grandfather, William Mackenzie, because he always spoke language all the time. He spoke wonderful English, and he was one of those men who always had a very strong presence wherever he went. And I think as children, he came to visit our house on a regular basis, and we saw him a lot out in the community at the Royal Show. He was always in his scout uniform, and he was always out to meet the Queen and all those kind of dignitaries that came. But he always spoke various languages. So you could hear him speak perfect English, and you also heard him speak traditional languages. And, you know, I just always remembered that, and I always kind of had it in my mind. I went to Monash University in Melbourne in the late 70s after doing adult matriculation in Melbourne after I'd moved there to live for a while. And I was with a friend who also was starting university, and I said to her, I'd really like to do linguistics. I'm a little bit nervous, but if you come and, you know, we go together, and we were all a bit kind of, you know. But we did. That's where I started again to kind of, because I knew there were people there that had worked with Australian languages, and I knew that that was the place where I was going to learn about them. So that was the start of it, I guess, in terms of my formal work, yeah.
So then it was a decade-long process to establish the research which allowed you to publish in 1994?
Yeah, it was ongoing. You know, I started... I went to work in Central Australia after I finished my degree, and then I went back to the East Coast in the early 80s and worked at Queensland Uni for a while and also a little bit in northern New South Wales. But I started during that time to kind of speak to a lot of the elders who still had memories much longer than mine. A new language, you know, had known quite a bit of language. So I started talking to a lot of them, and I also started listening to a lot of the IATSIS tapes, the tapes that had been recorded with our old people. And talking to other Aboriginal people in southeast Queensland. So there was a bit of a swirl going on, you know. There was a lot of kind of people wanting to do things and get involved with language and teach it. And it was a good time too, because people were still, there were still people around who knew people who spoke language, and they spoke some language, and, you know, so there was all that happening, which was great, yeah.
So how many people would you have spoken to who had the language?
I can't really say numbers
in
wise.
In the dozens or in the hundreds?
Wouldn't have been hundreds. It probably would have been, you know, 20 or 30 people. Yeah.
And then when the dictionary came out, have you found that there's been an interest amongst the people in reading and taking it up?
Yeah, I think so. I think that they really valued, because I mean, basically what I was working with were tapes and also historical documents where people had recorded language, you know, people that had settled in that area, people that had come and taken up land and had Aboriginal people working for them, living on the stations. lot of them wrote the language down. Some of the missionaries wrote the language down. So there'd been a number of source material, and a lot of people had come along in the 40s and then pulled together all the stuff that had been done in the 20s and the 1900s. So, you know, there's various stages of the historical documentation, and I just, in that first dictionary that was published in 1984, it was just a collation of all that material. After I did my master's at Melbourne Uni, I went back to work in Hervey Bay for a couple of years, and I did another dictionary, but it was just the Butchella language because I was able then to provide a lot of grammatical information. Grammar's a big thing in Aboriginal languages, but, you know, with reviving languages, we don't always go back to the old way of talking. We don't always use the traditional grammatical ways or patterns in that would have existed back there. It gets changed quite a bit, and people don't always like to learn. I mean, our languages are very much like the case languages, and they're very much like Latin. So they're agglutinative languages, and they add all these little bits onto the words, and the words can be quite long. So it's a bit hard for a lot of our mob to learn language because we're so used to just speaking English. So it's a bit of a challenge, and when you come to learn language as adults, it's always, you know, another added challenge. So we tend to kind of make it easier, I think.
So how many Indigenous languages were spoken on the continent?
Well, originally they say there was between 500 to 600 dialects, and then between 250 to 300 different language groups or language families. Yep.
And of those languages, how many would have been subject to the sort of research that you've done?
Quite a few, I'd say. There's been a lot of, you know, since the probably the 50s, I guess, there's been a lot of work done by linguists from attached to universities or to other bodies of, you know, linguistic research. And so there's been a lot of documentation and recording of language that's happened. And one of the things that linguists like to do, in particularly when they're in the in career positions as linguists, they like to go out and collect language and then analyse it and compare it to other languages. Part of that is also towards the contribution being made to linguistic biodiversity on a global level, because, as you know, globally languages are severely endangered at the moment, all around the country. Apparently the languages in Australia are the most endangered. We only have at this point in time 20 languages that have more than 1,000 speakers, and the biggest and fastest growing language in this country is Creole. And Creole is spoken by 40 to 50,000 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people across the north of Australia, and there are three major dialects of Creole. And they're all English-based Creoles, but they are languages in their own right. They have their own grammar and they have their own vocabulary. I mean, they originally start as contact languages, but they are now Creoles.
So do they, do you feel that they serve Indigenous identity well?
I think that the people who speak them do. They very much are part of their identity. From a linguistic point of view, they're killing off our traditional languages faster in collusion with English. So it's a bit of a, you know, two-edged sword in a way. Yep.
And of course we've seen with the various initiatives or actions of the federal government in recent times, some policy regarding language and the English language in Indigenous communities. Mm-hmm. What would your advice to Mr. Rudd and his department be?
Well, I think that my advice would be like the advice of many others that are offering up, you know, advice to the Northern Territory government and to the federal government, is that children learn better if they can learn through their own language, their first language. So in Australia, where Indigenous languages are still spoken on a daily basis, children should be allowed to have a bilingual approach to education, or as the Summer Institute of Linguistics is proposing and lobbying very strongly for, is a multilingual approach to language teaching. And that's not just for Indigenous languages, it's for all language groups. But the idea would be that children learn through their first language, and then once they've gained skills in literacy and numeracy in their own language, at the same time they may be learning English, and as that progresses. And once, you know, when bilingual education first started in the Northern Territory in the 1970s, that was intended to be the approach, and then it got changed, and then it got changed a bit more, and then it got weakened, and, you know, so now we're faced with a situation where they're insisting that schools teach English for the first 4 hours of every school day, and that if there's time in the afternoon, they can have some instruction in their own language. But in the Northern Territory, children quite often are very tired and very hungry. So after 4 hours of English, they will be exhausted. Quite often they won't come back to school, or they'll be quite lethargic if they're in school. And the numbers of language teachers in schools are quite small. So we do have quite a few Indigenous education workers, and quite a few of them would speak their own languages, particularly in Arnhem Land, around the Western Desert of, you know, the Northern Territory and South Australia, in places like Yindamu, Wallowra, Lajamanu, which are the big Walpri communities in the Western Desert, and a little bit on that East Coast where the Catholic Education runs schools at places like Port Keats and Dalley River and places like Bathurst Island. So, you know, there's a lot of different situations. The Catholic Education Department has a different approach, but really there are schools in Arnhem Land that are still continuing to teach through English, through their own languages, and that they're Yolngu schools. They've just stood their ground and they've been able to negotiate a bit of a compromise with the new CEO of the Department of Education and Training. So that's working well for them, I think.
And do those communities train their own teachers, or does Bachelor have...
Bachelor trains a lot of the teachers, yeah. We train Indigenous education workers as well as primary ed teachers, and also early childhood teachers, and Charles Darwin University is also venturing into that area as well.
This might be a good time to open it up for questions.
I'll propose not so much a question as an identification. You can understand from my accent, I come from Ireland originally, and we were occupied for hundreds of years by the British, and it was rather an unpleasant experience in lots of ways. And the language was one of the identifiers of nation. And the language was suppressed. And as in the situation here on this continent, our reward wasn't just being wiped, having our mouths washed out with soap and water. It would have been hot lead or dangling at the end of a rope, which was rather an unpleasant experience. It wasn't until the Free State was achieved in 1922 that the language was re-established in the official areas, and it has been restored practically fully, one might say, by having all documentation in the EU translated into Gaelic. So it's one of the official languages. It stands beside French and English and German. And one of our famous patriots, a man by the name of O'Donovan Rossa, while he was being buried, and Thomas Davis gave the oration, and he described language as a more important barrier than a fortress or river. It, as you say, it definitely identifies a people. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll take that as a comment. The what's your feeling, Jeannie, about the possibility of restoration of language? I know you've suggested that there's very few examples from around the world.
Well, that's one of them.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you say with Gubbi Gubbi and Butchula, would you see it being taken up even by a small number of people?
Well, Butchula's actually had quite a successful journey. One of my cousins has been teaching the language in Harvey Bay along with some other people who support her. And she did some training with me when I taught at the Cairns TAFE College. We were teaching Indigenous language workers courses, and she's now also doing her BA in language and linguistics at Bachelor Institute. She's just about finished. But she's been teaching the language for a number of years, and I did go back there to work for a couple of years after I'd done my thesis to help, you know, them develop materials and also teach the language to some adults, particularly young men who were wanting to write new dance songs, new corroborees. And they've also recently had a journalist come to live in Harvey Bay, I think it was 2 years ago now, and she wanted to run a series of Butchula language programs in the Harvey Bay Chronicle, and she consulted with the local Aboriginal organisation, and they agreed to support that idea. And she used the dictionary that I had produced, and it's been incredibly successful. And they nominated themselves. I think the journalists might have done the nomination for a United Nations Peace Award for reconciliation, and have received it 2 years in a row. And they are now being supported by the Queensland Government to teach the Butchala language in local schools. So, I mean, that is
in place now, Jeannie.
It is about to happen. They're negotiating how it's going to work, but it has been really successful, and I still give support in whatever ways I can. Joy and I talk a lot about, you know, what's happening with the program, and, you know, we sort of together come up with new ideas, and she talks to lots of other people. The State Library of Queensland is supporting, and I know that Rolly's involved with the State Library, is supporting language preservation and revival in terms of documenting, producing resources, helping people do research on their languages. So, yeah, there are a number of really good things, and you can look at the Kaurna Language Program in South Australia that's been going in Adelaide for probably 10, 15 years, and they've got a school where they teach the Kaurna language all the time. In Western Australia, there's a number of schools that support language learning through their Languages Other Than English program. They train their own teachers to do language teaching, which has been fantastic. It's had a few issues, but it's working quite well. The New South Wales government has developed and endorsed a policy for teaching Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages in schools, and that has gone quite well, to my understanding. I know also there is some glitches where people felt that they weren't being, you know, given a proper place in the system. They're being brought in to teach language, but they weren't necessarily being given the rewards or respect of their role, because they weren't trained teachers in a lot of cases. In the formal sense. So, you know, I think there are a lot of success stories, and they're different levels of success, and, you know, it's what the community regards as success. You know, the University of Sydney has a program for training Indigenous teachers to be language teachers. They've got a program going, a very strong program going in Victoria, where they've got training happening through Gippsland TAFE. You know, there's a number of things that are going on, and I think that, you know, generally speaking, where there are some programs that start and don't go anywhere, they might go for a little while, then they fall down because people, you know, there's just not enough resources or funding. So, you know, that happens certainly, but there are lots of good stories about what's happening.
Rob Forbes, you spoke briefly about the dangers of using oral history and relying on it too much, but what my question was, is oral history useful in maintaining the language and carrying the language forward to the people in the future? Yeah. And also, to what extent do English words get picked up and adapted into the language?
I think oral history is extremely important, and it's a part of our traditional practice. Is stories that are passed down through the generations, as it is with most cultures. And obviously, there are, you know, always those things that happen where people kind of change bits here and maybe exaggerate a point here, and, you know, miss out some other important information. But at the same time, it is a very valuable tool, I think, in language and in culture, and just generally in passing down history. Sorry, I'm not sure if I understand your meaning, your question about English.
I was just wondering, as English has adopted and picked up words from other languages that has been associated with the current, as it goes on, to what extent does that happen in the Indigenous language, where it picks up English?
Oh, quite a bit, yep. I mean, obviously, you see lots of Indigenous words everywhere you go. I mean, place names in particular in Australia, but there are other words that have been adopted into the English language. And, you know, the languages of Arnhem Land have adopted words from Macassan because they had a long history of association with the Macassans who came to the Arafura Sea. And the same on the West Coast with the Malay languages, you know, with the people that live and interacted with the Aboriginal groups on the West Coast. And the same would have been here. But yes, we've certainly adopted. And, you know, I mean, even in Aboriginal English, it's both ways. You know, we change words in English. We don't always use English the way other people use English, but we also use a lot of Aboriginal words. And quite often the meanings could change, or occasionally the meanings of the words might change. So, yeah, it does happen, I think, all the time.
Well, time's getting away, Jeannie.
Yep, no, that's
so,
fine.
Look, we thank you so much for you've come all the way from Alice Springs and going all the way back to Darwin. So, and it was really thrilled
you,
that you could make it here
Thanks
today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Jeannie Bell, everyone. Yep.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.